Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. All this week on Radio Boston, we're having conversations reflecting on 2016. We're talking with key thought leaders about things such as politics, pop culture, food, and art. And today, we're going to look at the year in civil rights. We're joined in studio by Michael Curry. He's president of the Boston branch of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP's Board of Directors. Great to have you back, Michael.
Great to be here.
So let's start with a topic that you've talked a lot about, and that's the pilot program for Boston police officers to wear body cameras. This program in the works for more than a year, and then it was delayed after no police officers volunteered to be part of the pilot program. In September, the program did begin.
Right.
And we're about halfway through this six-month program. Where do we stand right now? Do we know enough about it to say whether it's working or what's happening there?
Well, it's interesting. One is, as a student of history, I reflect back on the fact that you've had external or advocacy groups push legal or government entities to do the right thing. And I think about all the advocates that had to push this mayor and this police commissioner to consider the adoption of body cameras. And you've seen their rhetoric around this change over the course of the last year. I think one, credit to the city for adopting a pilot, but it can't be the end-all be-all because this was never about just adopting a pilot. This was about full adoption of body cameras. That's where the real fight is that we've gotten a pilot. The reviews of the pilot are mixed at this point. The cameras malfunctions with the equipment, the two vendors that they've used. But the challenge going forward is going to be, how do we wrap this up? How do we analyze the data and then start preparing for that full adoption?
Well, you know, you mentioned some of the reservations on the part of Police Commissioner Evans and Mayor Walsh. Let's listen to something Mayor Walsh had said about the pilot program. He was on our show in September after the court upheld the implementation of the program. Here he is.
Body cameras can't build trust in a community. What builds trust in a community is actually interaction with the community, with what young people in the office, in the community. You can't have interaction through camera, and you can't have it, you have to have it through dialogue.
So that's Mayor Walsh talking about the pilot program for body cameras. What might the data suggest thus far? Do we know whether these cameras, because that was also from the commissioner. He said this could hamper police interactions with the community. People might be afraid to interact with officers, or officers afraid to interact with members of the community. Do we know whether the cameras have had an effect in that regard at all?
Well, we know the data is evolving. And I think, as we saw in a Department of Justice report that I brought to the police commissioner and his command staff to take a look at, and that there are other reports that show that these are having positive effects across the country, reduction in use of force incidents, reduction in complaints against police officers. In fact, in many cases, they back up the police officer's view of what happened on the scene. It could be used for training and evaluation purposes. There are way too many uses that we're not talking about, and then we can work our way through the privacy concerns. So like the mayor, I don't believe it's the end-all be-all that we just have body cameras and we fix all of this, but it's part of the solution.
Hmm. You know, we did speak with former Boston Police Superintendent Daniel Linsky as well about the cameras, and he objected to what he described as the singling out of police officers as being responsible for significant racial discrimination. We should say we spoke with him, too, Supreme Judicial Court ruling. But first, let's listen to what he said about police officers, because I think this is on a similar theme. Here he is.
The majority of police officers do not leave the police station and intentionally racially profile. However, we've got a system, as the Reverend pointed out, that deploys more police officers to communities of color. And we deploy them in a more aggressive fashion.
So that's former Boston Police Superintendent Daniel Linsky. He says the issue of racism is a community-wide issue. It's not just something that has to do with police. What's your response?
Yeah, Dan and I have had this conversation. I always appreciate every opportunity I have to sort of engage him on these issues. I think the real issue is this. We give extreme deference to police officers, right? We give them a badge and a gun, and we pretty much go with whatever version they share with what happened at a scene. To whom much is given, much is expected.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is we are building in transparency and accountability to make sure that officers, as we see playing out across the country, can't lie or won't make up the circumstances on the scene of an incident. And we're seeing that that is happening. And I mean, Dan could say that 95 or plus percent walk out of the police station and they don't have an intention to racially profile or to discriminate. But I don't know what that figure is. I don't think he knows what that figure is. And I think part of the way to get there is with the increased transparency.
Mm. Now, I want to bring up the fact that we were speaking with him about a Supreme Judicial Court ruling that came in September. Essentially, the court said black men who try to avoid police and flee may have a legitimate reason to do so and should not be automatically deemed suspicious. Now, this made national headlines. This is quite a statement for a major high court in a state to make. What do you think is really the most tangible, I think, effect of that ruling?
Yeah, so what, I mean, again, it's one of the arguments around diversity in your courts, right? Because mm-hmm. we see in SJC, really under Governor Patrick, the diversity of our Supreme Judicial Court. With that diversity comes diverse perspectives, diverse ways of looking at the law. And what we saw here was a case where the court came down and said that it is reasonable for an African-American man or woman, based on the racial profiling that we're seeing play out, and they particularly pointed at the field interrogation observation stops that show a disparity in how people of color are profiled, if you want to use that term. I think it's an appropriate term. And that may prompt you to run. It may not be an indicator of guilt of a crime, but it may prompt you to flee. And I think that that's something you're going to see start to play out across the country.
You know, I've done a lot of stories about this, and I hear many people say we're so lucky in Boston. It's so different. Many of the horrible headlines that we're seeing from other parts of the country, those kinds of things don't happen here. True or false?
It's false for the most part. I think in college, when we used to do this work to get to increase diversity, we use the phrase the best of the worst, that you have a college that's doing better than other colleges, but it's nearly not good. It's not the standard. I think when we talk about these police issues, that phrase applies here. We have a situation where there is discrimination within the police department. I have police officers who point out discrimination in terms of how they're treated. I have citizens who come into our office who file complaints with us about police abuses. This city is not as bad as some other places, but it should concern all of us, and we should be working to try to eliminate that.
Boston Mayor Marty Walsh started conversations this year about, he says it's a year-long project to discuss race. Do you think that this will help?
I think it will help. I think, you know, part of any solution starts with the conversation, right? It's to assess where we are as a city and then to start figuring out what needs to be done. So I think, you know, credit to this mayor for facilitating these conversations. The only thing I've cautioned his administration is make sure they're open. Make sure that you're not trying to sanitize the conversation. As one of his attendees said to him, that you have to allow for a conversation where people are upset and people walk out not necessarily feeling good, because that's a true conversation about race in this country. So I'm hoping that he allows for the true experience of a conversation that is both revealing and ultimately healing in terms of racism in Boston.
If we go back just briefly to the subject of police, we also had the issue of social media and police. Boston police say they want to invest $1.4 million in software that monitors social media. Critics say this could threaten civil liberties, and again, potentially discriminate against people of color. You know, we spoke with Arlington Police Chief Fred Ryan about this just last week. His town did adopt a social media monitoring system 2 years ago. Let's listen.
It's our position that it would be irresponsible not to have some software program to enable us to be situationally aware of the conversation that's occurring in publicly facing social media posts in our jurisdiction.
So, Michael Curry, what's your take on that, that police need this software to be able to monitor social media because it's such a big player and could potentially provide evidence that could help in solving crime?
I think with the heightened concern we have for terrorism, civil liberties tend to erode when we're at extreme heightened fear. I think that's what we're starting to see play out across the country. And even though the incidents of terrorism are less rare here in this country, we are also feeling what the rest of the world is feeling. For us in the NAACP and ACLU and other organizations, there is deep concern with the use of this collection of data from social media. We already know that law enforcement can abuse those things when they are not checked, when the process and the policy doesn't have restraints. So we want to be a part of that conversation to figure out what this looks like. And then, I hearken back to a city council hearing where city councilors in Boston said we could better use this money for trauma response and for youth hiring, almost in line with the mayor's comment that the systemic issues aren't really about what's being said on social media, but what's driving people to commit crimes and to act in ways that are not in keeping with the law.
Remind us, where does it stand right now in terms of Boston police and monitoring social media?
Well, I know that they've gone ahead and moved forward with the $300,000 of that $300,000 coming from the federal government, and they're looking to select a vendor to provide that data, that access to the data. I know that we are engaged with the city council and others to be a part of that process. This process should not move forward without community involvement. We should be a part of that conversation. And that's really the critical ask from the ACLU, the Boston and the NAACP, and many others.
Mm. I want to just go back briefly to the state's highest court again, because there have been other things that have gone before the court this year that have been very important, mainly drug lab cases. The court is currently considering what to do with cases that may have been affected by former state chemist Danny Dukan, whether they should dismiss all of those cases because the drug testing that was to be used as evidence was compromised by her. At the same time, the backdrop to that is there are hearings going on in Western Massachusetts for another chemist who worked at the Amherst lab, Sonia Farrick, and she apparently was using many of the drugs, personally using the drugs that she was supposed to be testing. So obviously what happens with those thousands
Absolutely.
Of criminal cases. So this is going on in Massachusetts, and we haven't figured out a way to deal with these cases. What's your take on this? Do you think the high court needs to intervene here and say to district attorneys, this is what you need to do with these cases that use that evidence?
Yeah, I think the high court has been involved with various aspects of this case dating back 2-3 years now.
Right.
So I think the challenge for us going forward is, you know, how do we make sure that people who've been convicted of a crime that was based on tainted evidence by either of those two young women, that the person gets justice in that case. And it may not always feel good, right? Because we'd had one incident where a young man got out after it was found that he had the sample was a Dukron sample and he committed murder, right?
In Brockton. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, it ultimately, that's not the goal is to make sure that people go through the system and that their evidence isn't tainted, as we use the term in law, the fruit of a poisonous tree, that folks aren't have a fair process through our judicial process. And I think that, you know, Dukron is an example where the Supreme Judicial Court absolutely needs to weigh in and be a part of this conversation and make sure that every person whose sample was reviewed by her and Farrakh is reviewed.
And what about the Farrakh cases at all? What about those? I mean, in that case, we're talking about prosecutors under former State Attorney General Martha Coakley, and whether those prosecutors, in fact, covered up some of what may have been going on here.
Yeah, so this feeds to a broader conversation about conflicts between the relationships between prosecutors, labs, DAs, offices with police. I think one of the conversations that I hope will come out even through a legislative process is the conflict of interest that exists within our judicial process, our criminal justice system. As we talk about criminal justice reform, this is a great place to start because there's a taint in how we do justice in this country, and particularly in this case in Massachusetts. So I think the prosecutors need to be looked at, the communication. As we saw in one of those cases, the prosecutor had a regular conversation with the lab, with Dukron in that case. That's concerning because this needs to be impartial. There needs to be a system that prevents this from happening, and it's not happening as of today.
If we look forward to 2017 with a new president who will be responsible for appointing number of judges, 103 across the country, according to the Washington Post, how do you think this will affect Massachusetts most significantly?
Yeah, you know, I think one is I met with the U.S. Attorney's Office recently, and I had a chance on the heels of the Boston Latin School finding where they found a civil rights violation. And one of my concerns that I expressed to them, but it would be a concern I express to the FBI and any other, is how does the election of Trump impact the investigations that we so earnestly want them to pursue? And there is a concern there because, again, this BLS case, as an example, if this were Boston Latin School mm-hmm. under Trump may not have been investigated.
Really?
Because there is a tendency by the you know, whoever your attorney general is, to send a tone for what kind of investigations will be followed or looked into. And I think that we have a concern, and we know that the folks here in the U.S. Attorney's Office, we live by the fact that when we call them, they will investigate it, they'll be thorough. But then they have to eventually to sort of seek approval from the higher-ups when there are certain cases. And I wanted to make sure, and the NAACP is focused on making sure that a Trump administration doesn't impact that.
Mm. And, of course, we know Carmen Ortiz is leaving as U.S. Right. Attorney for Massachusetts. She just right. announced that, which she would have done anyway. But that's what you're saying.
Absolutely.
The person installed in that position is going to have an enormous effect on which cases go forward.
Absolutely. We find often in our cases of civil rights violations or discrimination cases that it is a discretion by folks in those positions to not pursue these cases. That is concerning for us, and the appointment of Jeff Sessions is really troubling to all of us across the country who are fighting for civil rights.
You will be leaving your post as president of the Boston branch of the NAACP January 1st.
Yes, I will.
Your successor, Tanisha Sullivan?
Attorney Tanisha Sullivan.
Mm-hmm. She investigated allegations of racial discrimination at Boston Latin. So what's next for you?
Well, I've been on the national board for 3 years. So I've been told by the chairman to expect a leadership role on the national board. I'm serving as vice chair to William Barber of Moral Mondays on the Legislation and Political Action Committee. And I just got appointed to be chair of that committee. So that'll take some work. We'll be working on repairing the Voting Rights Act, the criminal justice reform across the country, and a whole host of other issues that we've been fighting for. And now there's a significantly higher challenge now under this incoming administration and their record around civil rights. So we'll have some work to do.
Do you think you'll stay in Boston?
Oh, yeah. I'm born and raised here, and my heart is here. So I'll be traveling a lot. But I'll still be around and supporting Tanisha and others and the ACLU and other organizations that I've given my time to. I'll continue to work with them.
Okay. So we'll know where to find you.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Michael Curry, president of the Boston branch of the NAACP and member of the National NAACP's Board of Directors. He's been helping us look back on the year in civil rights. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.